Welcome to the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. This is episode number 3. My name is Mark Steven Schwartz, and it is both an honor and a privilege for me to read the diaries of Allied and American civilian prisoners of war interned in and around Kobe, Japan during the Great Pacific War, World War II. No portion of this story can be copied, duplicated, or used in reference in any way, directly or indirectly, without the expressed written permission of Mark Steven Schwartz, copyright 2019, all rights reserved. This episode continues with December 8, 1941, from Bryant Sterling. Native children helped me unload the food. Met Bill Gordonier and Jack Taylor at Alamogosa and gave them some pineapple and bologna. We headed back towards our camp. Met Bill Falvey coming up towards Alamogosa in his pickup. Tells me to meet him at Frank Borja's house. Passed through Agate and stopped at Borja's house. Noticed his front room is filled with contractors' luggage. I drove back to the camp. Trucks and cars are fleeing at a mad pace from Sumé. I'm warned to go directly back, but I kept driving on ahead. Heard planes overhead, so I pulled off the road under a tree to observe the planes bomb Agana. I climbed a telephone pole to watch the bombing of Sumé. Could hear the planes coming over Marine barracks. Could see the bombs dropping. Could see the pilot's body. Hear terrific vendoring crash as the bombs strike its objective. Bombers disappear, then I head for camp. I met Clark Eldridge at the camp. He asked me to pick up a native woman to take her into Agana. She has a brand new baby. She wants me to pick up her husband first. Walt Pleitner gives us some blankets. We unsuccessfully hunt for her husband for 1 hour. The woman decides to go to a farm halfway to Agate. On leaving Sumé, I pick up my trunk at the camp. I drop the woman off at the camp. I headed for Alamogosa, picking up natives on our way. We arrived okay and find Art Okapinti and Don Wallace. We ate a cold lunch served by John Petrovich. Art and I volunteered to go after kerosene at Aguada for the cook stove. We take the Ford truck. We didn't find any kerosene at Aguada, so we head for Agana. We painted the headlights black and picked up one 52-gallon drum of gas. There wasn't any kerosene at the naval canteen, but we were directed to the naval warehouse by a native. We picked up 5 gallons of kerosene there. We headed for Alamogosa Mountain. Agana was blacked out. It was difficult to see the road due to the blacked out headlights, slits for light. We arrived at Alamogosa. The Marines decided to take all trucks out of the vicinity, so a caravan of trucks headed for Agate. Reed Hubbard's pickup was in the lead. We arrived at Agate and drove to the left side of the road. We hid all trucks under trees. I put my trunk in Don Wallace's pickup. We headed back to Alamogosa. Spent the night there with Wallace, Art Okapinti, and Red Thomas. Slept on the ground. The mosquitoes were terrible. Harold Brinkerhoff. I went down to Agana with my men. We saw people with bundles on their backs, on bicycles, on jitneys piled high with household goods, and pulled carts stacked with every conceivable article, all streaming out of town in an endless caravan, everyone hurrying in all directions, but no panic. By noon, Agana was practically deserted. The 10,000 inhabitants had evaporated into the jungle or gone to the small villages. I went home for lunch, but my house girl, Chong, had gone with the rest. I opened a can of beans and ate half a pineapple from the icebox. I reported to the public works office and was told to stand by. All heavy equipment was supposed to be loaded with dynamite, ready for destruction. There was a bulldozer and a crane not accounted for. I was sent out to locate them. I found their tracks leading out of town towards Sinahana. I found them and was relieved to find they were loaded and ready. At least one fellow had done his job. I reported back and stood around for further orders. Reed Hubbard. Japanese bombers attack Sumé. Much bombing and machine gunning. By military order, we evacuated our camp, hauled all available food and supplies to the hills, and assisted the natives to leave. Bob Vaughn. When I returned from transporting injured men to the hospital, I started looking for our Pan Air people. We went as far back into the boonies as Max's car would go. Before heading out in the car, we had picked up a few supplies from the burning compound, the Pan Am Hotel and living quarters. We separated about 100 yards apart in the boonies. This was an idea to prevent all of us from being killed or captured. Charles F. Gregg, 12:30 p.m. Reported to Colonel McNulty, the U.S. Marine Corps commanding officer, that the radio was okay and could be on the air if he needed it. Coordinated plans with them to get all remaining food from the Pan Air warehouse and the cold storage container. Colonel McNulty and Major Spicer said to wait until late afternoon after the bombings were over. By that time, some contractors had appeared with a Marine sergeant and said they had instructed Al Hameleff to release the food by order of Colonel McNulty. Captain Flournoy gave me permission to get any clothing, equipment, or supplies needed for the Pan American staff from the Marines warehouse. So he took a pair of pants, a shirt, some socks, a hat, and a belt with a canteen and machete for myself. Later outfitted George Conklin, Dick Arvidson, Jim Thomas, Fred Oppenborn, and Everett Penning in similar fashion. I found Jim Thomas at the Marine barracks. He had opened the safe immediately after the first bombing and removed a significant amount of cash, checks, confidential papers, etc. I instructed him to burn all the papers immediately, which he did. I took the checks and cash. Supposedly, Max Brodowski had taken Grant Wells, George Blackett, and some others to Dade Beach near Agate. George Conklin and Dick Arvidson wanted to join them, so Jim Thomas, driving the station wagon, took them and the Cascow's boys and left for the beach. Bob Vaughn returned from taking the two Pan American Chamorro employees to the hospital. We took off the lifting crane from a truck, then drove around the Marine barracks, chauffeuring Marines and their supplies and equipment. During a lull in this activity, we stopped at the Pan American Buick and Bob repaired it. A battery wire had shorted. We then took the truck back into the boondocks and hid it. Bob and I then sat under a tree in the boondocks and counted the cash and made a record of it and the checks, destroying them prior to surrendering in order that the Japs could not trace the distribution of money, approximately $500 in cash and $250 in checks. Bob Vaughn and I then returned to the Pan American compound in the Buick and loaded all the stores left in the reefer into the car. We found the hotel kitchen and crew mess completely destroyed by bombs and fire. The percussion of the bombs had broken the walls of most of the rooms, and the plywood roof had been broken. Furniture in the old wing of the hotel was also aflame, but as all fire extinguishers had already been emptied by someone else, all we could do was throw out the furniture that was burning. 2:30 p.m. Later that day, another bombing raid occurred, and an incendiary bomb finished the hotel within 30 minutes. After leaving the hotel, Vaughn and I looked through the warehouse, building number 205, and found almost all the food gone. We loaded what edibles there were, together with medical supplies from Max's shop and my Air Express packages for the folks and Polly, into the truck. With this load, we started out to get together with the rest of the Pan American fellows at Dade Beach. We stopped, told Colonel McNulty where we were going, got some more Marine clothing, and headed out. Dean Brunton. In the afternoon, we received another raid aimed at the naval radio station. The Japs came back with a dozen planes, dived almost onto their target, dumped 34 explosive bombs, never scored a hit. Harold Brinkerhoff. Eyewitnesses said the Pan American Hotel was a mass wreckage, and one Standard Oil tank was set afire. Tonight I'm going to sleep in my own house. Where I'll sleep tomorrow will have to take care of itself. Charles F. Gregg. 6:30 p.m. After 4 hours of searching along the beach from Agate back to Sume, we finally found that the fellows had gone to the uplands of the Alamogosa Springs region. During this time, I gave some food to Joe Camacho and also the Christmas presents for the folks in Pauli. Driving through Agate and up to Alamogosa, we passed a regular exodus of Chamorros in old trucks, Fords, bull carts, and afoot hauling and carrying all they possessed. It was a pitiful sight to see these people hurrying along, driven by a fear of something they could not understand, bewildered, crying, with horror written in their eyes and faces. At the top of the hill, we met most of the contractor's men, Lieutenant Dean Morgan, some Marines, and at the end of the road, our own Pan American men, except George Blackett. The road ended at a giant bluff of a mountain. Deep tropical green grew on all sides of the boondocks. The contractors had worked most of the day with their big trucks, hauling canned goods and food up to this area. The supplies were dumped off the trucks in big heaps on the side of the road, later to be covered with palm leaves for camouflage. We ate a hurried meal of a slice of bread and a can of beans before darkness was upon us. After dark, Max Brodowski took his car, and while accompanied by Al Hamilef, George Conklin, Bob Vaughn, and Grant Wells, returned to the Pan American compound for clothes. Jim Thomas, Dick Arvidson, and I took the Buick and returned to the Marine barracks. Dick Arvidson and Jim Thomas put the radio station on the air. Dick Arvidson. About 4 or 5 members of the Pan Am staff returned by truck to the Sume base to carry out certain activities in anticipation of a Japanese invasion of the island. As a member of this group, my responsibility was to attempt to activate the radio station to listen in on the various radio circuits and possibly make contact with some other station to advise of our situation. Basic power in the area had been lost due to the bombing raid. Therefore, I activated the emergency power generator and listened on the various communication frequencies, which I found to be extremely active, mainly the Japanese communications, probably between naval vessels in the area. I was unable to establish contact with any other station. As a final activity, I did listen to some news from the United States on shortwave, and was able to understand in some detail, for the first time, exactly what had happened and what the extent of the war activity was. Charles F. Gregg. I contacted Colonel McNulty, who had no messages to send, and advised us not to transmit any messages for fear of Japanese interception. Closed the radio station and took both cars to the Pan American quarters for clothes, water in bottles, etc. Jim Thomas and I went through the office again and removed all flight books, operations manuals, and data on airplanes operations and procedures, etc. Later burned same. We also collected clothing at the Chamorro maintenance men's quarters. The Pan American compound was a wreck. Hotel burned down, crew quarters gone, bomb holes everywhere, and an eerie red light thrown over by all the burning of the oil tank. After loading up, we returned to Alamogosa. By the time we had unloaded the Buick and hid it in the deep growth, covering it with palm thatch. It was really black. Mosquitoes were everywhere, by the millions. Fred Oppenborn took a blanket apiece, a mosquito net, the only one on the hill, and crashed off through the brush for a quarter mile to a level spot, well hidden from the air and the road, and soon had some palm poles cut to hold the mosquito netting and were trying to sleep. It rained 3 or 4 times that night, but the blankets absorbed most of the water. The mosquitoes could not be absorbed, however, and really took good advantage of their opportunity. We did get to sleep, however, around 10 p.m. and slept spasmodically until 5 a.m. Results of 3 bomb raids the first day. Pan Am Hotel hit by 2 bombs and destroyed by an incendiary bomb. Crew quarters burned down. Gasoline drum storage gone, first bomb. 1 large Standard Oil reservoir tank, 87 octane, destroyed, and the paint burned off another. 1 Pan Am Chamorro co-employee dead from the first bombing. 5 Pan Am Chamorro co-employees badly injured. Perhaps 2 of these now dead. Only 1 of them has died. Total killed was 2. The office and shop machine gunned. All confidential papers destroyed. All cold stores, supplies, and food removed by unauthorized party or parties. Quarters badly torn up. Bomb craters everywhere. Max Brodowski. We got out from under as best we could, taking to the dense tropical jungle. Roy Henning. Bombs at 8 a.m., hid in a cave on the beach, stayed until noon, looked around, then went back to the cave. Went to the range at dusk and Alamogosa at night. I was with Max Brodowski and spent 2 days running over the island's ridges. Guam is about 8 miles wide, real jungly boondocks. I was exhausted by the second day. They had been bombing and shelling the island. We could see from our high vantage point that the island was ringed with Japanese vessels of all sorts. Each of those 2 mornings, we get up and charge out God knows where. Tuesday, December 9th, 1941. Charles F. Gregg. Up at 5 a.m., wet and hungry, but no time to eat. We grabbed cases of food and walked along a caribou trail for a mile to a native Nipa shack owned by Mr. Tovis of the Pacific Cable Company. He gave us coffee and some rice and barley soup. We decided to use this as a temporary food depot and madly dashed back to get a few more cases of food, then separated for the day and hid in the boondocks as we had been warned that this particular area was apt to be bombed that day. I took a blanket, can of fruit salad, and broke my way up to the top of Alamogosa Peak where I could see Sume, Petey, Umatic, and watch the planes come over and again bomb Sume, Pan American, Petey, and also Agana. Dean Brunton. The next day, December 9th, the Japanese did better. They aimed at the cable station and struck the corner of a house 100 yards away, owned by the fisherman whose wife had given him a warning on Friday. A few bombs were dropped on towns in various parts of the islands to terrorize the inhabitants. Harold Brinkerhoff. I had expected to have trouble sleeping last night, but much to my surprise, I slept as peacefully as if there were no Japanese waiting to capture the island. The other day, some natives had come from Saipan in a small boat and warned us the Japanese would bomb for 2 days and make a landing on the third day. The natives from the Japanese island of Saipan were relatives of some of our Guam natives. Several of our white personnel have taken to the boondocks, the jungle. I decided I will prepare to go there myself when the time comes. I went to the commissary and got my allotment of canned goods. After loading them in 2 burlap bags, I carried the food to the project site. I unlocked 2 tool chests and took out their contents. I put my food in the bottom, replace the tools, and lock the tool chest. I have done all I can to prepare for my stay in the jungle. I returned to the public works office for orders. Everything was in a muddle, more or less. No one seemed to know what to do. Evidently, no plans had been made to take care of such an emergency. Japanese planes came over it once again. This time they dropped 3 bombs on Aganya. One hit Tweed's house. Another fell in the garden behind the governor's mansion. It had been intended for the radio station. The third just missed the jail and took off the corner of James Underwood's store. It's too bad it did not blow the jail to hell, for all the local Japanese are confined there. I reported to the public works officer. He asked if I could handle dynamite. He wanted me to destroy the fuel tanks and supplies of the Pacific Naval Air Base contractors on Cabras Island. I did not think I had handled dynamite sufficiently to undertake the job. Lieutenant Schwartz sent me to a rotate point to run 5 large dump trucks over the cliff when the explosions on Cabras Island began. The destruction of materials and machinery was to begin only when a landing of the Japanese appeared imminent. We did not expect a landing until dawn of tomorrow. Bert Flaherty, Public Works, took me to Sumé in a government pickup. On the way, we had to abandon the truck on 2 occasions and take to the bushes. Japanese plane came down and machine gunned the road. Our truck was screened by the bushes, so we failed to hit it. This was on the 2 o'clock raid. We have had 2 raids daily for the past 2 days, one at 8 a.m. and the second at 2 p.m. We arrived at Sumé without mishap. I got out of the pickup near what had been the Pan American Airways compound. All that was left of the Pan American Hotel was a heap of corrugated roofing, twisted and torn. One of the Standard Oil gasoline tanks was pierced by shrapnel. Streams of gasoline were burning like blowtorches. Why the tank had not exploded was a mystery to me. All about are bomb craters. They're about 3 feet deep and 6 feet across. Up on the hill, I saw 2 walls of the cable station still standing. Mr. Perry, the operator of the station, was badly wounded, and 2 Marines were slightly wounded. I walked the 2 miles out to the lookout station on Arote Point. Just as I was almost to the lookout, 3 Insular Guardsmen, the native militia, passed me going in the opposite direction. The 5 dump trucks I was to run off the cliff were lined up beside the road, a half mile back from the point. I tried starting them to be sure I would have no trouble when my signal came to run them into the ocean. I had completed my test when one of the Insular Guards returned. He was one of the cruise boys. He told me the other 2 were frightened and were going home, but he was not afraid, so he came back. The lookout dugout was equipped with 2 iron cots, a coal oil stove, canned food, rice, and a telephone. These guardsmen had been sent to the point as lookouts and were to telephone the governor's office to report anything unusual. Charles F. Gregg. We came out of the hills and had a bite to eat at 3 p.m. Some wanted to go to our quarters for a bath and collect clothing, so Max Brodowski loaded his car and started out. Prior to his leaving, all of us except George Blackett, who was not with us, he was at another camp due to having a sprained ankle, got together and officially disbanded Pan American Airways. I advised the men that our Pan American organization of Guam, wherein authority was vested in certain individuals, was no longer effective. That henceforth it would be to our mutual advantage to stay together, working and cooperating as a group, but that as our very life would perhaps depend on possible forthcoming decisions, no one person could rightly require another to do something against the latter's wishes or best judgment. In short, each man was to judge for himself what was best for his personal welfare. At the conclusion, I gave each of the fellows $20 and the option of taking more cash if he desired, with the understanding that it might later be charged to his account. No one chose to take additional funds. Fred Oppenborn and I then went with George Blackett at a distant contractor's camp, following which we drove into Sumé for more clothes and our last look at the Pan Adder quarters and compound. We failed to meet Max Brodowski in Sumé, so we got two boxes of mosquito nets from the Marine store, and we started back to Alamogosa, again driving the winding, narrow mountain road at 20 miles per hour without lights. At the top of the hill, we saw occasional flashes of light off Umatak, and rumor was that a landing of the Japanese was being made. I left Fred and returned to the Marine barracks, taking a message from Lieutenant Dean Morgan for Colonel McNulty. Arrived there at 1:30 a.m. I filled the car with gas and water, went over to the supply building, got new pants, shirt, socks, and shoes, then by moonlight took a shower using the water hose by the gas pump and put on the clothes, then drove the car across the rifle range into the boondocks, camouflaged it, and reported to Major Spicer, gave him Lieutenant Dean Morgan's message, and laid down at 2:30 a.m. Harold Brinkerhoff. All during the night of the 8th, the boys had seen flashing lights from various points high on the mountains. They were frightened and would not sleep in the dugout that night, but took to the boondocks. I called the public works office and reported I had arrived at a Rote point. Just after dark, the lights began flashing on the hill behind Sumé. I picked up the phone to report the flashing lights. The line was dead. At 9 o'clock, we got the scare of our lives. Several eerie shapes slunk out of the deep darkness. It was Joe Indelico with a telephone crew. The office had tried to call me without success, so had sent Joe to investigate. He had found the line cut between Sumé and the point. Joe told me there wasn't any new developments, but the office felt the Japs would land during the night or early on the morrow. Soon after Joe and his men left, two other insular guards returned. They decided to come back and stay with us. We arranged two-hour watches, two men to the watch. Cruz and I took the first watch. I arranged the watches so Cruz and I would be on duty at dawn. That was when I expected things to start happening. We opened some canned food and had supper. At 10 p.m., I tried to call Sumé. The line had been cut again. Some of the local Japanese were still at liberty and were doing all they could to disrupt communications on the island. This made me all the more sure that a landing was building up and could break any moment. The night was uneventful. Dean Brunton. Tuesday morning, the grapevine announced that the Japanese would land Wednesday morning. They did, at daylight. Roy Henning. Three raids up in the boondocks, spent the night at Juan Torres's ranch. Bryant Sterling. Arose after a sleepless night. Art Okapinti and I rode in the pickup with a native mechanic to Agate to pick up a truck. Load my trunk onto the pickup. I was wearing a machete at my side. I found a truck. I drove to Frank Borja's house with Art. Art sees his girlfriend near the house. Says she and a bunch of natives had been hiding in a cave near the beach. Japanese planes were flying low overhead. Next, we go back to the camp. It was deserted. We stopped at the main warehouse, picked up a mattress. I looked the tool department over for any tools that we might need. Next, we went back to the old warehouse after some clothes. Had to force back the door with a hammer. We load up with pants, shoes, shirts, and socks. We headed back for Agate, dropped off her baggage at Borja's. My pickup picked up about 80 natives past Agate. Two guys hailed us. 80 more piled out of the bushes and climbed aboard. I took them to a ranch out on Fenna Road. Went back to the camp for food. Got a big load of staples and canned goods. Headed for Alamogosa. Picked up natives past Agate. informed by a Marine guard at the top of the hill that we can't take truck to Alamogosa, so we decided to go to camp number two, which is located at Malup Falls. Found Clark Eldridge and Reed Hubbard there, and most of the office staff. We were given a fine meal of boiled beef, bread and coffee, cooked in a native's house. Our next move was to Agate, in the truck where Art Okapinti and I made arrangements to stay with Mr. Bagate, the Marine officer. He provided food for us. We used our mattresses to sleep. Clark Eldridge, Charlie Craver, Art, Bagate, and I took turns watching for Japanese landing parties. My watch was around 2 to 3 a.m. A group of 10 to 15 contractors were lodged in a house up the street. The town was deserted except for us. Parked my truck near the house, ready to flee in case of a landing party. Still have 52-gallon drum of gas. Dick Arvidsson. I remained in the Fina district during the day. The surrounding area is shelled by Japanese destroyers offshore. Relocated to a nearby ranch and slept at that location. Sleeping was a problem because it was done on the ground, outside, and the area was full of mosquitoes, which made sleeping virtually impossible. Wednesday, December 10th, 1941. Max Radofsky. On the third day of a relentless attack from sea and air, the little brown supermen poured onto the beaches. Our 125 Marines had little chance against the thousands of the well-armed and well-supported Japanese troops. Charles F. Gregg, The Surrender of Guam. 1 a.m. From 1 a.m. to 4:45 a.m., I remained at the field post of the Marine Commandant, Major Spicer, in readiness to follow any orders relevant to destruction of Pan-American equipment and supplies. Since the island's U.S. Naval Governor, Captain George J. McMillan, had not given the go-ahead signal, the Commandant refrained from taking such action. Dick Arvidsson, 2:30 a.m. We considered moving further into the interior due to a more protected area, but the plan is not carried out due to darkness and unfamiliarity with the local terrain. Chuck Gregg, Charles F. Gregg, 3 a.m. By 3 a.m., it was known that the Japanese were landing at several places on the island. At 4 a.m., machine gun and rifle fire was heard in the direction of Petey, and the glow of burning buildings was seen. While I was lying down, Star and a group went out to 1,000 steps to check on a reported landing party. He found a boat with construction markings, Midway Island, capacity 25 persons, but no people. Shortly after he returned, a glow appeared over Petey, and machine gun fire was heard. On return of Star, Colonel McNulty issued orders for the Marine munitions dump to be blown up, and Lieutenant Marks left with a party to accomplish this mission. Plans were laid to prepare for landing parties in considerable numbers at Sumé. Walter E. Durham. On December 8th and 9th, the Japanese bombed Guam. During those two times, I used my medical experience and my medical kit for several injuries. December 10th at 4:30 a.m., when I arrived at the lower part of Agana, Guam, I was machine gunned by the Japanese and forced to stop my car. They took me out of the car and searched me, and they thought I was lying about being a civilian because I had a medical kit in my car, so they knocked me over the head, stripped my clothes off, and smashed me in the face. But the worst part of it was two of them took me down onto the beach and made me run, and I could see myself laying there just as dead as a doornail. They then took me and tied my hands behind me, bumped me up the road, and finally, after a few blocks over towards Agana, they picked up six more Navy flyers who were attached to me by a rope. Charles F. Gregg, 4:45 a.m. The commandant ordered me to take a message to Lieutenant Morgan in charge of the Marine Detachment at Mount Alamogosa, also to take two other civilians then at the command post to Alamogosa and remain in hiding until we receive further orders. Taking a message from Morgan, I started out for Alamogosa. Sidney McMichael of the cable company and his assistant, George O'Connor, decided to go with me. We picked up several Chamorros and took them to Agate. Agate was evacuated and Chamorros were running wildly to the hills. At the crossroads to Agate, Agana, Sume, we passed a Navy driver from Agana with death written all over his face. We learned that Agana was surrounded by the enemy. On request, we told the driver how to reach the command post. Past contractors' men scattering in the hills who confirmed Agana had fallen. The commander's message was delivered at 5 a.m. to Lieutenant Morgan, who said parties of Japanese had landed at all beaches and Agana was badly shot up. He started groups back into the deep boondocks with cases of food. I hid the car and joined the Pan Air group who were hiding. Roy Henning. On the third day, Max shook me out of sleeping in the shack where the cable operators had lived. He said, "Come on, Roy, it's getting light and we've got to get going." I said, "Max, count me out. I'm going to stay here. I don't care anymore." It was true. I had run out of stamina and had run out of fear. It's funny, but fear had disappeared at that point. I was petrified up to that stage. So Max took off, probably crossed the island several times, but each night he'd come back to the same place with the other guys going with him. Dick Arvidsson, 6 a.m. Heard rumors that the Japanese are landing on Guam. At this time, we observed many Japanese vessels offshore, including what appears to be troop transports. 8 a.m. Heard rumors that the military forces on the island have surrendered and the Japanese are rapidly occupying the island. Harold Brinkerhoff. I took the binoculars Cruz had. Dawn broke and in the distance, standing off Agana, I could see a Japanese fleet of two light cruisers and five troop transports. Everywhere within my view were destroyers patrolling back and forth. The war has come to Guam. All hell will soon be breaking loose. Cruz and I returned to the dugout to tell the other boys. They had deserted us during our watch. We did not see them again. Cruz and I ate breakfast. We watched and waited impatiently. Orotai Point overlooks the entrance to Petey Harbor. There is a sandy beach below the dugout. We expected Japanese might make a landing here. All was serene, not a Japanese to be seen. At 7:30, we got thirsty as we had run out of water. We went down to the beach to get some coconuts. To get to the beach, we had to go down a set of steps cut out of the solid coral cliff. On reaching the top of the steps, called Thousand Steps, we found four Marines. Colonel McNulty had expected the Japanese might land there and use Thousand Steps to reach Orotai Point and the road to Sume. If we had known these Marines were so close, we probably would have slept better last night. We got some coconuts and quenched our thirst. We had barely reached the top of Orotai when explosions commenced on Cabras Island. My signal to run the trucks off the cliff into the ocean. I went to the furthest truck, stepped on the starter, and raced up the road for the cliff. I had only gone half the distance when one of the 8 o'clock Japanese raider planes appeared and swooped down and machine gunned. I felt no truck was worth my life. I ran it off the side of the road and made a run for the dugout. Standing in the doorway, Cruz was firing at the plane. His 30-30 did no more damage than a pea shooter. The Japanese plane circled and dropped bombs in an attempt to destroy a Marine ammunition magazine a couple hundred yards down the road. His bombs overshot by several hundred feet. The plane wheeled and disappeared. I said to Cruz, "Let's go shoot holes through the motors of the truck, blow the tires, and call it good." We hurried over to the furthest truck and took turns blowing holes in the motor and tires. While we were busy, a pickup drove up and several Marines got out. They told us that the Japanese had landed at Dunga's Beach, east of Agana, and at Marizo, the south end of the island. The Marines set charges of dynamite in the ammunition shack and detonated them. Then all hell broke loose. There was a terrific explosion, and thin shells began popping like a battle was being waged. There was a lull. Cruz and I thought the shells had all exploded. There were still three trucks on the other side which had not been taken care of. Taking no chances, we dashed across in front of the ammunition shack. Just as we were passing, shells began exploding again. I heard an anti-aircraft shell pass between Cruz and me. We reached the safe spot and sat down to wipe our brows. What a close call. When our heartbeats returned to normal, we completed our job on the three other trucks. We did not see how the trucks could be made use by the Japanese, as all the trucks had large holes through the motors and the tires were all flat. These were huge all-metal dump trucks. The commercial Pacific Naval Air Base contractors were using them to haul massive boulders for the breakwater being built to protect the harbor. The harbor was being dredged so that large ships would be able to anchor inside. Ocean-going ships with deep draught would have to anchor outside the breakwater and have their goods transported to the docks in shallow draught ship-to-shore boats. Cruz and his relatives lived on the other side of the island. We decided to try and make it over there. We entered the dugout and gathered the canned food, put it in a gunny sack, and started for Sume. We had to make a detour around the ammunition dump, as shells were still exploding. It was tough going, trees and vines to trip us, and coral, sharp as razors, sticking up like rough honeycombs. Finally, we made our way back to the road. When near Sume, we decided we had better detour around the town. It was highly possible that the Japanese were in possession of Tsipiti, the port, and Sume as well. A half mile south of Sume, on a Rote Point road, we found a Marine Corps truck hidden in a coconut grove. It was filled with canned food. A short distance further, we found some Marines concealed in the bushes. We were shooting the breeze with them when the order came from Colonel McNulty for them to go to the Marine barracks in Sume and surrender. We accompanied the Marines to the junction of the Agate-Sume Road. Before the Marines left the jungle, they took the bolts from their rifles and threw them in the deep bush. Their canteens, sidearms, and all other accoutrement went in the opposite direction. Cruz and I went into the jungle to retrieve a couple of canteens for our journey over the mountain to the other side of the island. We found a canteen for each of us. We had almost reached the highway when a speeding contractor's pickup with a Japanese flag draped over the hood turned the corner just ahead. The only cover was some tumbleweeds. I dropped behind one of these. The brakes of the pickup screamed. It came to an abrupt stop. I stood up as I was sure the Japanese would start shooting. Cruz and I walked to the pickup. There were two Japanese in it. The driver motioned for us to get in the back. Cruz had dropped his rifle in the weeds when the pickup had stopped. As we drove away, I took the binoculars from around my neck and tossed them into the bushes along with my canteen. We were driven into Sume, where the Japs stopped in front of a store. The driver got out and went in. I asked Cruz who owned the store. Cruz said it was owned by a Japanese named Ben Cook. A Japanese bomb had hit and destroyed one corner of his store. Ben was without a doubt a Japanese spy. He probably had something to do with the signal fires we had seen the past few nights. I followed Ben into the store and said to him, "Are you going to turn us over to the Japanese?" He answered that he was. I looked closely and could see that he had no guns, so I said, "Goodbye, Ben," and walked out. Cruz was nowhere to be seen. I decided if I was to be captured, I wanted to be with some of my fellow Americans. Charles F. Gregg, 11:30 a.m. There was a loud honking of horns, and a truck of the naval government, driven by U.S. Marines, arrived at Mount Alamogosa and brought word that Governor McMillan had unconditionally surrendered the island, and all had surrendered in Agana and Sumé. The governor instructed that all Americans throw away any machetes, knives, or firearms in their possession and surrender to the Japanese at Sumé. All Pan American staff members complied with this order. In three cars, they drove toward Sumé, where the surrender was made. Contractors, with Gus Gilbert leading the group, took McMichael, O'Connor, Conklin, Penning, and Arvidson with them, and left for Sumé. Left a note for Brodowski, Thomas, etc., and for Lieutenant Dean Morgan, when they could not be located, and told them of surrendering and governor's wish that all Americans should report immediately for joint surrender. Monday, at the time of dissolution of Pan Air organization, prior to giving Tovis, cable company employee, the camera, we took a picture of the Pan Air group and left it all with Tovis, who was to endeavor to save these items. Did not know what to do, but gave Tovis all money, clothing, equipment, and camera. Then, with Oppenborn, Hamilef, and Hansen of the Pacific Cable Company, started down. I was going to give them the car and go back, but decided not to do so because of the possible consequence to the other Pan Air group. I was plenty scared and worried about being questioned, but decided to face it. Grant Wells. We were captured together with a couple other men in Maxie's car, a 1937 Chevy four-door sedan. That was the third day of the war. We were ordered to surrender by the Japanese. Leading up to that moment, we had been hiding in the hills, seeking refuge from the invading Marines, 5,000 Japanese. The decision was clear-cut. Come in and surrender, or be hunted out by dogs and shot by machine gun teams. We chose coming in. The end result couldn't be worse. Orders came by U.S. Marine runners who had already surrendered down in Agana. Bob Vaughn. One of the construction company employees came up with the info that if we would surrender now, we wouldn't be harmed. We piled into Max's car and started down the road where we met a squad of Japanese soldiers who ended our freedom for nearly four long, miserable years. Roy Henning. We got word that Governor McMillan had surrendered the island, that we were all to surrender. I felt somewhat relieved, actually. There was a pickup truck from the PNAB, the contractors, and we piled into that. There were several incidents along the way. Charles F. Gregg. Max loaded up his car and led the way down to Agate. Before leaving, I told the men, "This is the end of Pan Am. We can stick together if you want to," and I recommended that we did. So we drove on down the road to Agate, a little town right on the beach. The peninsula where the Pan Am compound was situated was Ruby Peninsula, and Agate was another half mile beyond. We drove about one quarter mile from Agate, round a curve on this road, and back of four cars of contractors led by Mr. Eldridge and Hubbard. Along for the surrender with the contractor men was Bill Falvey and Ken Hardy. We were confronted with a company of Japanese Marines. They had landed on the beach at Ruby and were still wet. Since there was quite a bit of coral, they beached their boats and walked ashore with their camouflage gear. They were pretty high. They had been given some dope or something like that. The reason I say that is because their eyeballs were dilated. They motioned us with fixed bayonets to get out of the car. They lined us up at the side of the road and put a machine gun in front of us. In back of us was a ditch. The lieutenant in charge or captain of the platoon or company, I'm not sure what it was, but there was about 50 of them altogether. Suddenly, attention was called by one of the subordinate officers that a car was coming up the dirt road. Dust. You could see it coming up. The car drove up the road and stopped. From it emerged two Japanese officers in white naval uniforms with epaulets on their shoulders and their naval swords. And a third officer got out without as much breath, but he was still well decorated. It was the Japanese who had run the restaurant, contiguous with a Pan Am compound, a place known as Ben Cook's. The old story was he had been shipwrecked several years before. They asked him what his name was, and he thought they were asking what he did. He said, "I, Ben Cook." That's all he would admit to. This had been several years earlier, 4 or 5. He subsequently worked his way up until he owned a restaurant. It was really a bar, served hot dogs, sandwiches. It was really primitive. It was primarily habituated by the Chamorro personnel and some of the Marines when they would go off their barracks, because this was contiguous with the Marine barracks. This was within 100 yards of the Pan Am compound. When the guys got paid, we paid them in cash weekly, the Chamorros would go over there and load up with a few beers, even though we'd counsel them otherwise. I had been there only 2 months, and I visited Ben Cook as a courtesy call. A couple of months later, he called upon me. He asked me, "Mr. Gregg, would you help me? Several of the Chamorro Pan Am personnel have sizable bills and haven't paid up. I would appreciate it if you would help me collect the money." I told him it wasn't Pan Am's policy to serve as an intermediary, but I would talk to the men. I thought they were all reasonable boys. We got along well together and thought something could be done. So I got these men together, had a list of their names, and explained what had happened. I told them, "Pan Am's reputation is at stake here, and if you don't pay your bills, then Pan Am's reputation goes to put. We may have to release you and get someone else who is more reliable. So we don't want to make hardships on anyone, but let's set up some regular ways so that you can take money over and pay off this bill." So this was worked out, and these bills were paid off over a matter of within 6 weeks. Quite a bit of money. I don't recall ever having seen Ben Cook more than once after that. I went over, everything was up, and he was, very pleased. "So nice, Mr. Gregg." He was in this car with these two naval officers. He got out, turned, and spoke to the naval officers saying something, including Pan Air, indicating we were all Pan American employees, and that we could be trusted, or I don't know what he had said. But they chattered back and forth in Japanese while this damn machine gun was in front of us with these wet, hop-eyed Japanese soldiers. And finally, this captain, or commanding officer, gave some order to the Marines. They pulled their machine guns back and assumed position. Ben Cook then spoke to me and said, "Mr. Gregg, you will get back in your cars and you will follow the car we came up in, which was a truck. There will be a machine gun mounted in the back of the truck. There will be another convoy to meet us when we get to Agana that will cut in back of you. You will be safe and nothing will be done to you if you don't try to run away. You will be taken to the construction camp at the edge of the Marine barracks where they had construction shacks for a crew of about 150. Then they put a guard in the car and we followed a truckload of soldiers into Sume. The soldiers had a machine gun and rifle trained on us the entire way. We were driven into the camp, and here flying from the flagpole at the top of the mast was the first time we saw it, a great big flying Japanese flag. It was real. We were unloaded and told to take our bags into one building used for sleeping quarters. I immediately got rid of a very pistol, shells, and two Filipino knives I had in my suitcase. Clark Eldridge invited me to come into his room and had a beer. I took a shower and got cleaned up. All Pan American personnel had taken a little bag of clothes. Before I got through taking a shower, the Japanese soldiers came after us with fixed bayonets. The order came in for us to get the hell out and line up. I jumped into a pair of pants, shirt, and tennis shoes and was taken over to the Marine barracks. That was the last I was to see of my clothes and toilet articles. They fanned us out on the lawn, circled by bayoneted Japanese Marines. We were lined up, searched, names and occupations taken, and cars taken. While we were there, we saw Max, Thomas, Wells, and Vaughn drive by in Max's car. Shortly afterwards, Black had appeared in our group on the lawn, so assumed, and later confirmed, that all Pan Air fellows were okay and all had surrendered. Then they loaded us into trucks, Japanese trucks that they had landed, and took us up to the jail. Roy Henning. I don't know if I was down at the crossroads before or after Chuck, but it was pretty much the same scenario. We came down in a pickup truck with Jack Taylor, Carl West, and a few other contractors. Charles F. Gregg. I think Roy came down before we did because, as I recall it, we stayed up and cleaned up the lot up there. The order came up from one of the adjutants of the governor to turn ourselves in. There were several cars, and I kept our gang back as a rear guard. I waited as it was a case of seeing if the others got through. Then we'd be all right. Roy Henning. I thought that was going to be the end right there. It looked pretty much like it. Dick Arvidsson. We decided that the Pan Am staff should surrender intact to the Japanese. We proceeded in a truck out of the hills towards the Sumé area, and at the junction of the Agate-Aganya Road, we encountered occupying Japanese Marines that signaled that we should stop the vehicle. We, in the back of the truck, observed the Japanese signal, but the driver had not slowed down because he had not seen the Japanese. There was a tense moment when the Japanese assumed that we were not going to stop and aimed their firearms at the truck. In the meantime, we struck the roof of the truck to gain the driver's attention, and he did stop. We were stripped and searched by the Japanese occupying forces and then loaded into another truck along with other prisoners and taken to what became to be known as the bullpen in the Agana area. Harold Brinkerhoff. I made my way up the cliff below the Marine barracks and was walking across the grass towards the barracks where I could see some Marines showering and changing clothes. Just then, I heard a terrible screeching. Charging across the grass towards me roared a detail of Japanese Marines. Details of Japanese Marines had surrounded the barracks and forced the American Marines outside on the lawn. Five Japanese came at me. They gesticulated, trying to make me understand something. Finally, I caught on that they wanted me to strip. I took off my shirt and dropped my dungarees where I stood. They herded me over to where the Marines, in the same state of nudity, were sitting on the grass. Some were in worse condition than I, because at least I was wearing tennis shoes, shorts, and an undershirt. A Japanese officer arrived. With him was a Chamorro from Saipan who spoke English. Through the interpreter, the Japanese officer asked Major Spicer, the commanding American officer, if all were military personnel. Major Spicer said all were military except for me. The Japanese officer said I should go home to Agana. I said I did not want to be running around without a pass. The officer said we would have to wait until his superior officer arrived. We sat in the hot tropical sunlight for several hours. The boys without clothes began to look like lobsters. Another civil service employee, Hans Sockers, was brought in. The high-ranking Japanese officer arrived. I asked for a pass for Sackers and me, and he gave us one. After I retrieved my pants and shirt, Sackers and I started walking along the highway for Agana. We had gone several miles when a truckload of Japanese Marines picked us up. I showed them our pass, but they made us get in the back of the truck. On arriving in Agana, the Japanese officer in the truck asked for our pass. He departed with it. In a few minutes, he returned and motioned for us to follow. He took us over to the Insular Guards Quarters, otherwise known as the bullpen. Inside, we found about 300 of our countrymen and native guardsmen. By night, there were over 400 of us in captivity. Thus concludes Episode 3 of the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. Thanks very much for listening.